you know, what's a very special whole time period that we're in? Obviously, hockey playoffs. Right. And so there's a Minhug, and it's actually a pretty significant Minhug that started about 40 years ago. In 1980, the Islanders, New York, I'm a New Yorker, although not Long Island, New Yorker, so I'm a Ranger fan. But the Islanders were doing very well, and everyone on the team was growing beards. And they won the championship, and it became a thing that in hockey, and then it spread to other sports, that people grow playoff beards. And there are a lot of halakhos behind it that if you don't shave, but if you lose a game in the series that you're playing in, for those who understand what I'm talking about, then you're allowed to trim. And if you win the championship, then you have to keep it even throughout the summer, but that's not so easy for the top. There's a lot of intricacies, and it's not just that players grow beards, but as we hear, there are fans that will grow playoff beards. And so a couple years ago, the Rangers were in the playoffs. I'm in New York. I'm sitting in a subway car, and I'm dressed, you know, however I'm dressed like a Jew would. And I see across the car, and there's a man with like the same scraggly beard that I have wearing a Rangers jersey. And we lock eyes. He smiles at me. Smile back and nod. And then I think for a second, I don't think anyone's ever smiled at me and nodded on a New York subway. And I'm like, oh, he probably thinks that he has a beard for the same reason that I have a beard. So not exactly. I like the Rangers. I don't know if I was growing a playoff beard for the Rangers. But why do I have a beard? I have a beard based on the first source of my packet. Because during this time period, it's not just the playoffs, but additionally, Rabbi Akiva had an unfortunate circumstance. Rabbi Akiva, getting into his backstory, had a very interesting backstory. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students. And during this time period, the 12,000 students died. Rabbi Akiva was the Gadol HaDor. All the Torah that we have comes from Rabbi Akiva. And so it wasn't just that one teacher's students passed away, but Torah fell away. And the source tells us in the bold that all of these students from every Jewish community, Kulan Metu v'Perek Echad, they all died at the same time. And why did they die? Something that many of us have likely heard. B'nei Shelo Nahu v'Kavod Zeh LaZeh. That they didn't give kavod, they didn't give honor, respect to one another. And then the Gemara points out the magnitude of what this is. It's not just that Rabbi Akiva lost his students, but the world lost their Talmid Chachamim. The Hayah Olam Shamim, the world went dark. We lost all of our rabbis. Imagine every shul rabbi all over just passed away in one period of time. What was that period of time? We have the bold. Kulam Mesu, Pesach, we have Sarah. Pesach and Shavuos. So I don't grow a beard during this time period just because of the playoffs. I have a beard because we're mourning. Mourning for the students of Rabbi Akiva. I'm a twin. I have a twin brother named Daniel. And from time to time we watch family movies. And my brother had this thing that sometimes you watch a movie and it's full screen. Sometimes it's widescreen. To this day, I don't really understand what the chiddush of widescreen is, why you'd ever want a movie with widescreen. But when it's widescreen, instead of filling up the whole page, it just sort of cuts off. You get part of it, and there's black on top and bottom. And I don't know why. My brother, very smart guy, he notices most things. He never saw that it was widescreen, unless we pointed it out. And if I pointed it out to him, he'd be like, oh, I didn't even notice. And then the whole rest of the movie, he's seeing widescreen. But if I never pointed it out to him, he never saw it. And I think that a lot of things in our Jewish lives, we sort of just see and we don't really pay attention and we don't fully grasp, we don't think about it until someone points it out. And we don't necessarily see the wide screen in front of us. And so we're familiar with this story, but it seems odd. Because we have sad times throughout Jewish history. There's a day in Jewish history that is dedicated to sadness. The 9th of Av, Tisha B'Av, is a sad day in Jewish history. And so if all the students of Rabbi Akiva are going to die, if something terrible is going to happen, not just to Rabbi Akiva, but to his students, why would it be right now? Why would it be between Pesach and Shavuos? Seems like it makes more sense to put it at a sad time during the 3 weeks over the summer, around Tisha B'Av. Maybe you put it around between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I had a teacher who used to say, you know, the leading cause of death in the world is Rosh Hashanah. Think about it. Rosh Hashanah, everyone's fate is decided. And so if they needed to die for some reason, maybe around then. You could hear a drush in like 3 years when he thinks you guys all forgot this. He's going to use that line. And why are they dying between Pesach and Shavuos? And it gets even weirder. Because when we talk about Pesach, we talk about Shavuos, you have Passover, which is the Jewish people left Egypt. It's like the engagement between the Jewish people and God. And then you have 49 days of Sfira, which is like the engagement period, which is all exciting and festive. And then Shavuos, the pinnacle, the climax, the wedding between God and the Jewish people, or God and the Torah, or the Jewish people and Torah. This should be a very exciting time. Sfiras Omer should be, we should all be happy and jumping up and down every day. Adar should be boring compared to what Sfiras Omer could and seemingly should look like. We should be so excited about the fact that we're going to marry God, we're going to receive the Torah. But it's not. And this is something that my personal family is kind of experiencing. My sister got engaged last year, and then my grandmother fell ill. You know, passed away, and then my sister got married. And then my brother got engaged, and my grandfather, Bubby's husband, fell ill, died, and now we've got my brother's wedding coming up in the summer. And I can personally tell you that standing in a funeral with my future brother-in-law next to me is kind of weird. There's like an excitement and like a sadness, and then we go to the wedding, and it's beautiful and it's exciting, but it's also a little bit sad. And why have all this mixture of feelings, of excitement and sadness? Why does the time period of Pesach to Shavuos need to be marred with the death of these Talmidei Chachamim? And so I think the Maharal explains it, but we need a mashal. Because if we're talking about the fact that this is a wedding, then when you have a wedding, you have two parties that come together, decide they're going to get married. It's very exciting, it's warm, you have a party maybe, and then there's a process. An engagement time is very, very busy. You hear that someone's engaged, and you assume that like they're like off the board for the next however many months because they're not going to do anything productive except for plan a wedding. Planning weddings a lot. And so my parents had to plan weddings and funerals, and they've been crazy for like a year because of all the things that they have to do. And so when there's a wedding, then usually you'll split things up. And so, you know, one side is going to get in charge of the flowers and the photographer. And, you know, they have their whole side has to get all of the proper clothing, the suits and the dresses, the kule. And the other side is in charge of the caterer and the hall, and they have to get their dresses and suits, the kule. And so what happens if you have one side who gets the photographer and they get the florist and they've got all their things ready, and the other side doesn't prep anything. There's no caterer, there's no hall. Nope, they didn't buy rings. When it comes to the wedding date, you're not going to have a wedding. There's no wedding that you could possibly experience. There's no ring. Like, halakhically, you can't even have a wedding because there's no ring. Forget like, oh, you know, we can't have this big party. You can't even have the basic need for a wedding. What the Maharal explains is that Rabbi Akiva's students had to die during this time, this unfortunate time, where we're building toward a wedding, toward the wedding between God and the Jewish people, because they weren't filling their side. They were supposed to be the side of the Jewish people, preparing to receive the Torah, and they weren't. They didn't do it. They didn't book the hall. They didn't call the caterer. They didn't buy the rings. So you can't have a wedding. So Maharal phrases it a little bit differently, but he says that the time period. What preparation do you need? What preparation is necessary for the Talmidei Chachamim of the time to build toward receiving the Torah? Says it's kavod, it's honor, it's respect. And he says in the bold, "Od yish lefarish ki hazman hazeh mipesach v'yad hatzeret." This time period, from Passover until Shavuos, mora al kavod haTorah. It's about kavod haTorah, honoring and respecting the Torah. Sorry, we're in source two. And then skipping the brackets, the students of Rabbi Akiva, lo nasu kavod haTorah. They did not honor the Torah. They know kavod zebazet. They didn't honor one another, and by not honoring these Talmidei Chachamim, they were not honoring the Torah. Lefichach, therefore, Nesumi Pesach v'yadav Seret Dafka. So they specifically died. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't an unfortunate coincidence that they died during this time period and that we're now growing beards instead of celebrating. Because they were not being machabe, because they were not showing kavod, honor, respect to one another, they had to die right now. So kind of answer the question. Could they be really? Because what does that mean? What does it mean that they weren't showing kavod to one another? These like shul rabbis who were like getting up and making fun of each other during their drushes. They're picking on one another. What is not showing respect? If Rabbi Gutstein walks in, I don't stand up. I'm not kidding. And one of the other rabbis doesn't stand up. Is that a lack of kavod? Is that what's happening here? Were they being mean to each other? Can we possibly imagine that the students of Rabbi Akiva are mean to one another? So what does lo nagu kavod ze baze actually mean? I'm not too sure that this is a question that just I have. I think it's possible that Rabbi Akiva's future students had the same question. Because after Rabbi Akiva lost his 24,000 students, he got five more. And the Gemara tells us that, and the Midrash tells us that he had five more. And this might be my own idea, but I don't think it's so crazy to think that the students of Rabbi Akiva, these five new students, are a little nervous. What do you think happened with those 24,000 students? Why did they die? What was so bad about what they were doing? And maybe even that they were nervous about becoming students of Rabbi Akiva. Maybe there's something unique about being a student of Rabbi Akiva where you don't get to live forever. You only get a finite amount of time. Maybe Rabbi Akiva is too holy, and if you're not on the right level, you're not spending enough time davening, or you're not spending enough time preparing, or you're not reviewing the Torah, learning well enough. Maybe if you're not up to par, then you don't get to stay with it. And he's out of this world also. There are plenty of people who would argue the opposite, but I'm not those people, and I'm the one here tonight. But maybe they were nervous. I could just like picture this conversation at the shul where someone's like, what Yochai's kid is doing. Yochai's kid is going to be Yeshimon. He's going to be one of the Rabbi Akiva's new students. Oh, I can't believe it. You know what happens to Rabbi Akiva's students? You know, I really like that kid, Shimon. I don't really want anything to happen to him, but we know what happens to Rabbi Akiva's students.
He didn't have the
yoke And so it's possible that even Rabbi Akiva's students, these five new Talmidim, were a little bit nervous. And I had this question for a while, and I finally found an answer. Obviously, I was not looking for this answer. I was looking somewhere totally different, and this popped up, because that's usually how it works. So the top of page 2, source 3, is a midrash in Bereishit Rabbah, where Rabbi Akiva probably understood that his students were nervous. So he gave them a pep talk. I guess maybe this is like the first day that they're going to learn together. And he says, Amar Lahem, Rabbi Akiva says, B'niyai, my children, my students, let me tell you what really happened. Harishonim lo metu ela shahaita enehim sara batorah. Elu ba'elu. I'll tell you exactly why my 24,000 students passed away. Because they had enehim sara in the Torah of their friends. They had narrow eyes. But you five new students, tnu daitchem. Pay attention. Shlotasu kamaseim. Don't do like what they did. And then the Midrash concludes and tells us, Amdu umilu kol eretz Yisrael Torah. And so these five students took heed of the warning. They got up and they filled all of Israel Torah. It worked. Seemingly this warning, this pep talk worked enough that these five students were able to effectively learn and teach Rabbi Akiva's Torah. And to think for a moment about the significance of these five Talmidim, we said that the students are Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua. There's a general rule in the Gemara and the Mishnah. If you have a Mishnah and you don't know who authored it, oftentimes we'll play around in the Gemara, and the Gemara will try and figure out who wrote this Mishnah, because you have one Mishnah saying this and one Mishnah saying that, and it seems like they're contradicting. And if they're both the same person, that doesn't work. And so we always try to figure out who authored this Mishnah, who authored that Mishnah. Generally, if we have a Mishnah with no authorship, we can't figure out who it was, we assume that Rabbi Meir wrote it. And if we have a Braisa, which is like a Mishnah, and we don't know who authored it, we assume that it was Rabbi Yehuda. These Rebbeim weren't just students of Rabbi Akiva. These were the foundational personalities and minds of our Torah. Even till today, if I have a Mishnah, I don't know who authored it, I know that it came from Rabbi Akiva's student, Rabbi Meir. These five students didn't just suffer the same fate as the first 24,000. They flew. They were the top. Our Torah that we have today comes from them. And of course, on Thursday, we're going to celebrate Lag BaOmer. That it's not just that they were, and that's commemorating Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's Yotzei. Rabbi Shimon, the Rabbi Shimon that we talk about in this Gemara, is our Rabbi Akiva's student, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was the forefather of Kabbalah, of mysticism. He revealed so much hidden Torah to us. And so I get that the issue was that there was Tzarasayin. There was Nara'ayin. They didn't really engage, didn't really appreciate the Torah that their friends were sharing. But if we're going to be intellectually honest for a moment, is that so bad? Because let's think about what these rabbis are doing. That they're trying to figure out a halakha. And the halakha, let's say it's a question about food. You know, we had a big pot of cholent for Shabbos, and a little bit of milk fell in. And how much milk doesn't matter, and they're arguing, one saying that this is totally fine to eat, and the other one saying you can't eat this. For the person who makes a compelling argument saying you're not allowed to eat this food, to say, I disagree with what you're saying, is that so bad? How else do you decide halakha if you can't disagree? So what's so bad about having tzaras ayin? What's so bad about not really engaging what your friend's saying? It's the opposite opinion. And to understand that, I think we can look at the two of the parties that disagree most. Maybe not most, but who are very, very popular disagreeers throughout all of Torah Shabbat Path. Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. Their predecessors, Hillel and Shammai, disagreed about three things, but almost nothing. But as generations went on, there were more and more disagreements. And Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, the houses of study from Hillel and from Shammai, disagree over 360 times throughout Shas. And there was one disagreement in particular that got very heated, lasted for a very long time. For 3 years, they argued about halakha. One said this, one said that. And they could not figure out what the halakha was. They couldn't figure it out. And ultimately, they never did figure out it out. Instead, a basketball had to ring out. A heavenly voice was heard from heaven and said, at the arrow in source 4, Yatzta basketball called the Amra. Elu v'elu divrei Elohim chayim. These and these are the living words of God. The halakha, in the next line, to Beis Hillel. Even so, the halakha is like Beis Hillel. So, Beis Shammai, you're totally right. Beis Hillel, you're totally right. We're collectively going to follow Beis Hillel in this case. And so the Gemara explains, why do we end up following Beis Hillel in this case? Because when we'd have this dispute, that Beis Hillel would preface the opinion of Beis Shammai before teaching their own, and Beis Shammai would just teach their own opinion. And so Beis Hillel was nice. They were nice people. And so we follow the halakha according to Beis Hillel. But once again, if we're being intellectually honest, we were just told by this heavenly voice that both this is right and this is right. That the person saying the cholent is usser is right, and the person saying the cholent is mutter is also right. How can both of these people be right? You can't have two people who are diametrically opposed, who are saying the exact opposite thing, and both of them be right. How does this work? It doesn't seem to make any sense. Any thoughts? Okay. For that, I think we can look for the next source. In the next source, the Ritva, a Rishon, a commentator on this Gemara, asks the exact same question. And says, what's going on here? How does Elu v'Elu work? In source 5, in the bold, as he explains, we'll get to the bold in a second. He explains that when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Har Sinai, what happened? Moshe got the Torah. So he got these two tablets. Beautiful. But we know he got more than just the two tablets. He got the oral Torah, the Torah Shebaal Peh. Well, what does that look like? And so the Ritzvah explains to us that what he got was that he was said, there's going to be a halakhic question out there. There's going to be a question, you know, what do we do with this chalon, with our little milk villain? And Moshe Rabbeinu was taught 49 ways to say that it's okay to eat, and 49 ways to say that it's not okay to eat. And so Moshe Rabbeinu asked basically the same question. What do you mean 49 ways in each direction? How can there be 98 different ways of looking at one thing? And so he asked the Kadosh Baruch Hu, what's going on here? How is this going to function? And so now in the bold, second to last line in source 5, the Omar, Kadosh Baruch Hu explained to him, these 49 ways yes and 49 ways no are going to be given to the wise people of Israel. And in every generation, they'll figure it out. They'll have 49 different ways to look at it in the positive and 49 different ways to look at it in the negative. And in each generation, they'll take all these different ideas that they have access to and they'll figure it out. And for sure, this is true. There's no question about it. Rashi and somewhere else explains that people are just seeing it from a different perspective. That someone else from their life circumstance sees it one way, and someone else in a different life circumstance sees it a different way. It's not so different that if you and I are sitting across from one another, and there's one number, there's a digit in the middle, you could look at it, and tell me, no question in your mind, it's a 6. But if I'm looking at it, my contacts are in, I know that I'm seeing clearly, and I don't see a 6. What do I see? I see a 9. Just because I'm seeing a 9, you're seeing a 6, doesn't mean that either one of us are wrong. In fact, we're both right. However, we're looking at it from a totally different perspective. Torah was given on a mountain. I don't think that was a coincidence. It's a very strong message there, because when you have a mountain, there are a lot of ways to get up to a mountain. When you think about Masada, any of us been to Masada in Israel? Masada, this big, huge mountain. So there are three normal ways to get up. There's the snake path, which lots of steps, and you go zigzag back and forth. There's the Roman path, which is like a 20-minute, like somewhat steep climb, but very underwhelming if you thought you were doing the snake path, which happened to me once. We were planning on taking this. I run a lot of Israel trips. I'm taking a hiatus this year so we can give more shiurim over the summer. But I've run many of them. And one year we told our driver, okay, you know, we're going to Masada, and we had this whole plan and we got there early. And the expectation was we're going to spend about an hour and a half climbing the snake path, which is a lot of time. But you know, little kids, and so we wanted to make sure we had sufficient time. And then we get there and we look, and I'm like, this doesn't look like I remember it. And he's like, no, this is for sure it. So we get out and we start walking, and about 2 minutes in, I turn to my tour guide. I'm like, Arya, is it possible we're on the Roman path, not the snake path? And so it took us 25 minutes and we were up there and we had so much time because it was just a cute little walk up. Right. So you have the snake path, you have the Roman path, and then you can take the cable car. You could also, I guess, in theory, you could scale it with like a pickaxe or whatever, however people do. But when you have a mountain and you want to get to the top, there are different ways of getting there, different ways of seeing it. Mountains you can look at and they look very different depending on where you're coming from. And so whether you're looking at a number, or you're looking at a question in Torah, there are different ways to look at it, different ways to see it. And so that's how we understand what Eilu v'Eilu Divrei Elokim Chayim means. That's how it works, that's how it functions. And this is a much deeper idea, and if you want to learn more about it, because Shavuos is coming up, and you have a wonderful rabbi who can spend lots of time preparing it. but on the level that we're understanding, Eilu v'Eilu means that, yeah, okay, there are different ways of looking at this, and just because what you're saying and what I'm saying are totally different and totally opposite, it doesn't mean that it's wrong. There can be more than one way of approaching something, more than one way of understanding Torah. So you can literally have two completely divergent opinions and have both of them be true. So I understand why it was a problem for Rebbe Akiva students, Tempsarasayan, to look down on the opinion of their peers. What I don't understand is, what were they supposed to do? Because if you're trying to decide a halakha, if you're trying to figure out how am I supposed to carry myself in this world, and forget food, because food, you know, worst case scenario, we eat something that's like a little bit kosher, or a little bit not so kosher, we'll get over it. What if we have a case where it's a little bit more serious? What if we have a case where a couple's trying to figure out if they're allowed to be together? What if you have a case where someone might be married, might not be married? You know, this happens all the time. Thank God it never happened on my Israel trip, but halakhically, in order to get married, a man has to give a woman something of nominal value, like more than a quarter, and say a certain phrase with two witnesses, and that's it. That's a full marriage ceremony. We build it up a lot, but so that's very nice and very easy. It's also very scary if someone does that by accident. And so you'll have this has happened on at least two occasions that I'm aware of. You'll have high schoolers who are like messing around on the bus in Israel, and one guy will propose or marry some girl, and there are two witnesses there, and now they're married. and so we're not going to recommend that get a hotel room separate from the ones that we have. We want them to get divorced, but they're halakhically married, and then it's very uncomfortable for the young woman, because now she's a divorcee, and someone who's divorced doesn't marry a Kohen. And so even though she's 15, 5, 10 years later, whenever it is that she's going out with someone, she has to make sure that he's not a Kohen. Kohen can't marry a divorcee. So what if we're trying to figure out, are these two kids, these two 15-year-olds who are messing around on the bus, are they married? Then, this is pretty serious. We're talking about adultery, or not a problem at all. And when you have such a stark contrast, we don't just want to say, either side could be true, either side's right. It gets pretty serious. And this happened also with Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai were talking about a case of Yibum. And in Yibum, you have this very stark contrast. Because in Yibum, you have two options. On the one hand, let's backtrack and explain Yibum for a moment, this is going to come up in Rus, so this is coming attractions for Shibboleths. But in Yibum, if you have two brothers, one of them gets married and doesn't have a child and passes away. Now, he was never able to carry on his lineage to the world. So let's say the brother's name is Shimon. Shimon dies, and Reuven is still sticking around. Then there's a mitzvah in the Torah for Shimon's late wife to marry her brother-in-law Reuven. And now Reuven and the new wife are going to have a child, name it Shimon. And that in that way, Shimon's legacy will be carried on throughout history. It's a beautiful idea. We could look into it more some other time. But there's a slight problem, because Yibum is a beautiful mitzvah. However, if the couple did have a child, Shimon and his wife had a child, and then Shimon dies, and Shimon's wife decides to marry her brother-in-law Reuven, that's not only not a mitzvah, it's actually a massive, massive affair. We call that one of the arayos. It's one of the forbidden relationships. And there are three mitzvot for which we'd rather lose our lives rather than violate them. This is one of them. So you have a very stark contrast between a big, 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 big mitzvah of Yibum and a very, very big, a very, very big sin of arayos, of illicit relationships, of being with your brother or sister-in-law. So when we're trying to figure out yes or no, it's a pretty heavy subject. And as you can imagine, it's Hillel and Beis Shammai who are trying to figure this out. And it's a mishnah in Masechta Yevamos, the top of page 4, source 6, where they were at a standstill, that they didn't have a real answer. And people in the house of Shammai said one way, and people in the house of Hillel said another way. And so you'll end up, if you have a child from an illicit relationship, we call that a mamzer. A mamzer is a very unfortunate situation, the result of an illicit relationship. And mamzers don't marry other people. They can only marry a mamzer or a few other cases. If you know any mamzer, then consult the rabbi. I don't have to worry about that. I just come in for 45 minutes and then bounce. Just leave lots of issues. But you have a case of a mamzer, that's pretty hefty. Beis Shammai is like, no, this this boy, this girl is not a problem. And Bass Hill is like, excuse me, she's a mamzer. That's a very, very intense contrast. So what'd they do? So we had, you know, we had a case maybe Beis Shammai was Machshir, and then in the arrow on the right side in the Gemara text, this is an excerpt from the actual Gemara, Beis Hillel was posted, that they invalidated, they said that this couple was not allowed to be together, and the child was therefore a mamzer. However, and this is so beautiful, Af al pi, even though She'elu osurim ve'elu matirim, that they said this is a problem, and they said this is totally fine, Elu posim ve'elu matirim, and you know, the ones who said fine in one case said it's a problem in another case, and the ones who said it's a problem here said it's fine over there, Lo nimnu beis shamai milisa nashim mibeis hillel. The people, the families who were the students of Shammai, didn't stop themselves from marrying the women and marrying the family members in Beis Hillel. Lo beis hillel, mibeis shamai. They still married one another. Now let's think, let's take it further. Kol ataharos v'atameos, v'hayu elu matarim v'elu matarim, lo nimnu osim taharos elu agave elu. And the objects that were pure or impure, depending on the opinion, they would use them all together. It wasn't a problem. So let's understand that Beis Shammai or Beis Hillel, doesn't really make a difference, said that this person is totally not allowed to get married to a conventional Jewish person, and they still and these people could have them running around everywhere. They could have them zerim everywhere because they're pro a relationship that we think is totally a problem. And yet, still, they said, "Okay, yeah, we'll marry the Beis Shammai family. No big deal." And you know, they had food that was tamei, that was impure. And if someone who wants to eat pure food, if I say that you know this cup is impure, pure because of whatever circumstance, and you say that's not impure, then you know, we could be sitting around eating. I go to your house to eat, and you put out a cup, and I just start eating from it. I don't know that it's pure or not pure. I can't keep track of everything that you own, and I just have to trust you. And yet, even though there are pretty weighty things going on, marrying a mamzeres or a mamzer is a pretty significant violation, they would still marry them. So the pessimist in me wants to say that this is actually a problem, that this is like, you know, putting us, oftentimes people, particularly today, will say, let's like put us, I have a friend, another one of the rabbis in the Kollel, who has, you know, a lot of books, like you. Many of us have a very unhealthy relationship where we need to buy more and more and more books, even though we're never going to get to all of them. But it's not going to stop me. And so I was looking at his bookshelf, and I saw that he has a book called Put God Second. That's an interesting title. So I pulled it out, and I start looking at it a little bit. And basically, the author was arguing that there are objective morals, and we should put those morals at the top, and anything coming from God, we should put second. That, unequivocally, without question, as far as I'm aware, is heresy, and I actually commented to him, and he's like, yeah, I think I'm going to get rid of this book, because the notion that there's anything that's greater or more supreme than God is totally incorrect. We have a concept of Derech Eretz Kadmah LaTorah, that you should be, if you're not a nice person, then you can't receive the Torah. And that's often the explanation of this first Gemara that we saw. You know, why did Rabbi Akiva's students die? They weren't nice to each other. But it's hard to imagine that these holy rabbis were just not nice people. But so we will put aside certain things for the sake of making sure someone's not embarrassed or making someone feel good. We'll be a little bit more lenient. We don't want to embarrass someone. It'll often come up. You know, if you're in a situation and you happen to know that someone's doing something wrong, but it's not so wrong, then oftentimes we'll just let it slide. That's why it's important to know what's a big mitzvah, what's not a big mitzvah, what's a big avera, what's not a big avera. But this is a big avera situation we've got going on here. You don't just let it slide and marry someone you're not allowed to marry so that no one gets upset. So Rashi is awesome here. Rashi explains what happened. It's not just that Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai put aside their halakhic differences, saying, even though we think you're totally wrong, we're gonna jump in anyway. Rashi explains that after this little the mem in the bracket in the Rashi script on the left, says, "Afilu haki lo nimnu Beis Hillel milisa nashim beis Shammai." that they still married one another. And then in the underlines, Lefi, Shehayu Modiyim, Fim Lahem, Osan Habaos, Min Hatzaros, Uporshim. What happened? I'm planning on marrying a very, very nice young woman down in Beis Hillel, and I'm marrying a nice woman from Shammai. And someone tells me, you can't do that. Because even though as far as we're concerned, she's totally fine. As far as you guys are concerned, she's Mamzeres. You're not allowed to marry her. And they would tell each other. And they'd be at a Shabbos meal, you know, and they'd all be eating, and I would reach for the rice, and they'd say, oh, no, you can't have the rice. The rice, as far as you're concerned, is impure. For us, it's totally fine. We don't think it's impure, and so we're not going to stop ourselves from having it, but, you know, we only have so many dishes, and these are all about the holy dishes, the pure dishes, and this one happens to be impure. No rice for you. Okay, Polishin, you are so much rice. And they would be actively telling us. They're not just saying, oh, I appreciate that you have a different opinion than I do, and that both of us can be right. They said, I'm not going to let you mess up your own opinion. I'm going to look out for you and say that if you disagree with this, even though I think you're totally wrong, I'm going to make sure that you don't mess up. I'm going to make sure that you don't violate your own opinions, your own perspectives. And that's kavod. That is really respecting one another. That's respecting another Talmid Chacham. Saying, even though we disagree, and I think that you're being absurd and ridiculous, you don't know how to think, even so, I'm going to honor and respect it. I'm going to make sure that you're aware that, as far as you're concerned, you want to stay away from this. And I think that the fourth year of the Imri Emes wraps this up very, very beautifully. He says on the last page, and in the bold, this is also quoted by Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. I like the way that Imri Emes said it better. It says, "Kishim she'ein partzufeim domin zelazeh, kach ein daisan shavin zelazeh." When we look around this room, and there are 12 different faces, no one gets upset. No one's upset that my nose looks like this, and my eyebrows are a little bushy, and that I've got hair. Well, maybe someone gets upset about the hair. Who knows? But no one's getting upset about the fact that I look different than you do. And I'm not upset that you look different than I do. That would be absurd. And so too, why would someone ever get upset if someone thinks differently? If I think one way and you think another way, why would I ever be upset about that? Why should you think like I do? You don't look like I do. So the way your brain works should also look different. Should also function differently. And he goes further and says, based on that understanding, nonetheless, ulam, after the comma, so when someone disagrees with you, someone has another opinion, you have to be okay with that. To be sovel something is almost to carry that burden. Vayichan, when we talk about the Jewish people receiving the Torah at Har Sinai, we said Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar, in the singular tense, the entire Jewish people encamped at the mountain. What does that word Vayichan mean? Humi Lashon Chayin. This is not exactly what it means, but that Vayichan has a connotation of chayin, of grace, of beauty. Shekol echad matza chayin b'ene chaver, that each and every person found something positive in their friend. Yeah, I think you're totally wrong. But I can still appreciate how you're right. And I can still appreciate that you have a valid opinion. Now, there's a caveat that I have to sort of explain within this context. Because as we see today, there are lots of different opinions. And I spoke to Rosh Hashanah, the Rosh Hashiva of YU, about, you know, if we have this concept of Elu Elu Divrei Elokim Chayim, how come there are times when you yourself will get up and say, that person has an idea that is totally wrong? It doesn't say, I disagree. It doesn't say, it doesn't make sense. It says, it's totally wrong. And he explained to me that there are certain processes that we're supposed to follow. And so this is part of the Elu Elu Divrei Elokim extension, that, you know, when is something still part of the words of the living words of God that are living and active and can be and are to some extent malleable, and sometimes it will be more left and sometimes more right, sometimes more this, sometimes more that. And there are times when if you don't follow the right procedure, you don't play by all the rules, then that's not part of the words of God. That's no longer words of God. That's words of something else. And that's why we'll have times and cases where you have big rabbis who seemingly should be understanding this message, who do understand this message, saying that someone's opinion is not just different than mine, but wrong. The details of that, maybe we'll talk about next time I'm around, if we're interested. But But we keep the students, thinking back, you know, why do they have to die right now? Because right now we're building up to receiving the Torah. Right now there's an essential piece that the Maharal explains to us, that part of building up to receiving the Torah, getting ready for that wedding, is covered a Torah, of honoring the Torah. And what does honoring the Torah actually look like? Of being able to say, even though you and I think very differently, still, I'm going to recognize that your opinion is part of Torah as well. Because Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim, that both this and that, these two divergent opinions, are both part of God's Torah. And that's okay. And in our personal lives, when someone has another opinion, as long as they're thoughtful and considerate about it, they follow the right logical process, or in the case of halakha, there's a halakhic process, and that's okay. And we see this in our daily lives. It comes up a lot, particularly, probably fresh in the minds of many of us, because if you're around here, or you're in Israel, over Pesach, the difference between an Ashkenazi and a Sephardi is very intense. For Ashkenazim, they're stuck in eating terrible, terrible stale crackers for a week. For Sephardim, basically their lives don't change at all over Pesach. They just, everything costs a little bit more. Because now instead of them having wheat flour for their lafas, they have rice flour for their lafas. And they've got rice, and they've got sushi, and they've got hummus. Pesach's great for Sephardim. And everyone wants to be Sephardim for 1 week. 6 months from now, in Elul, when the Ashkenazim for 4 days have to say Slichot early in the morning, and they're like, oh, this is so tough. They're like, I'm so glad I'm not Sephardi, because the Sephardim have been saying it since the beginning of Elul, but it serves them right, because they've been eating rice on Pesach. But we're very much aware that there are Ashkenazim and Sephardim, and they have different approaches, different halacha, different laws, and we don't say, what's wrong with these people? How come they're looking and acting differently? And so we can totally appreciate that. They follow a different process, a different path. They're looking at it from a different perspective. But when someone's disagreeing with us, maybe not in terms of Jewish law, but they're disagreeing with us in some other context, how do we interact with that? How do we respond? Are we trying to see how they might be right? I had this experience today. I was running a program with a friend. I was just helping him, and he did something that I thought was totally incorrect. And afterward, I told him, you were totally wrong. You can't do it like that. And today I realized, hold on. I never thought for a moment that he might have known what he was doing, that he did it on purpose, that maybe, I don't know exactly how every program should look. And so, God willing, tomorrow when I see him, I'm going to ask him, what were you thinking? What were you trying to figure out? Why did you take a different approach than I did? Because Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim, if he's trying to do something, he's got the right intentions, he prepared the same way that I would, maybe he figured it out a different way. There's not just one way to approach this. There's a whole mountain. There's 49 different ways, yes, and 49 different ways, no. Which leads us back. 8 o'clock. One other thing. On Lag BaOmer, we're going to celebrate the Yahrzeit of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And this is all totally my own imagination, I don't have a concrete source for it. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai did something no one had ever done before. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, I'm going to record all the hidden mysticism of the Torah. And we had Mishnah, we had Gemara, and people were talking about the revealed parts of Torah, halacha, and what things are supposed to look like, how to read the Chumash. But then mysticism, Kabbalah, is like a whole other level. And where did Shimon get the confidence and the comfort to be able to do this? I think it's because his four other colleagues were all students of Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva taught them, don't have tzaras ayin, don't be narrow-eyed at your friend's Torah. When your friend says something, if they follow the right path, then that's part of Torah also. And so Rabbi Akiva maybe even showed and expressed all of the Kabbalah that he wanted to share with his friends. And they said, Rabbi Akiva, I don't know that I agree with you. I don't know that this is something that I would teach. But Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim. And so I'm in. Okay, if you want to publish this, go for it. Because you did all the right things, you followed the right path, and that's okay. And finally, we started with beards. And what do beards do? Because how did the playoff beard start? It started in the 1980s, but I didn't tell you the whole story. Dennis Potvin, who was the captain at the time, said that they started growing beards just because they didn't have enough time to shave. That they were so focused on the playoffs that they just didn't shave for a few days, and all of a sudden the whole team had beards. But for the next 100 years, people grow playoff beards. And Butch Goring, although it wasn't just Butch Goring, a lot of people have commented that there's like an awesome element of a playoff beard. Because when you wake up in the morning, you look in the mirror and you see like, there's like all this hair growing on my face. You're like, what? What's it doing here? When you wake up in the morning, you see someone else with a beard. You go into shul and you see the rabbi's like, rabbi hasn't shaved. What's that doing here? Oh, it's the playoffs. Oh. And then you start thinking about the game. You start getting ready for the playoffs. I don't think that's so different than what Jews do. Jews also have a beard. It's not just a coincidence that we don't shave during this time, but we have our own versions of playoff beard, our sphere of beards. And the other practices of mourning that we have during this time period, and when we think about it, if we take a moment to remember, you know, why am I listening to talk radio instead of to music on the radio, we can remember every day, all the time. Why? Because sphere, we're building up to Kabbalah Satorah. And how do I build a Kabbalah Satorah? By remembering, Elu v'Elu, Divrei Elokim Chayim, that both of these are part of the living words of God. Thank you very, very much.
Just a picture here of the six and nine.
Yeah.
It's reminding me of the story of the